It's Saturday, August 7th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and talking about different things like DEF CON and...
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
For something completely different, for those listeners who miss Devo...
We're through with being cool. We're through with being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
That worked okay, I guess.
Yeah. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Lyle taking a break. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. I'm Miles Elam. In the air room with me are Ben Jaffe.
Good morning, everyone.
Freelance media guy, Stanford instructor. Lindsay Lonnie, system analyst.
Good morning.
Hello, Alex.
Good morning, Miles.
Alex is an application security analyst and our Southern California correspondent.
So, Miles, why did we sing the theme?
Because I missed Devo.
You lost the cable, didn't you?
I lost the cable, and I missed Devo.
You got to remember to bring that cable, to connect the computer to the board. You know,
so I don't have to remember anything. I'm sure people who are listening love our melodious voices and would love for us to continue doing so in the future.
Mm-hmm. Every week. Every week here at 10 a.m.
So let's get going. Ben, you have a new story?
Yeah. So who here likes cake?
I do.
No, I hate cake.
Would you prefer pie?
Oh, you mean the actual pastry. I thought you were talking about the band.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the number. So yeah, I want to briefly go through some quick history about pie because we actually hit a milestone. So way back in 250 BC, using a polygon with 96 sides, Archimedes got pi to two digits, so 3.14 something, something, something. Many of us have heard of the approximate ratio 22 sevenths. Moving forward, Liu Hui in 263, the year 263, again with a polygon with 3,072 sides, got it down to five digits. And then we just moved on from there, especially Fibonacci took a go at it, got it to three digits in 1220. And then around the 1500s, 1600s, we actually started getting a lot of people attempting this, all of them without computers. And then the first attempt with a computer was in 1947. They got 710 exact digits of pi using an arctangent method. And it only went up from there. We got into the billions in 2002.
That
trillions.
Old arctangent method.
Yeah, so we got past a trillion in 2002. Turns out now we're at 5 trillion. Some people put together a computer program to do this. It took them 4 months to do these calculations. They used 22 terabytes of disk space. That's 22 trillion bytes. And just to store the output after they compressed it and everything, 3.8 terabytes, right? So that's way, way, way more than any person has in their home as far as storage space. And this isn't storing movies or games or anything. This is storing digits of pi. So talk about geeky.
Compression. That seems odd to me because pi is such an irregular number. Mm-hmm. Compression doesn't seem like it would be very effective with pi.
I'm sure there's some way, probably having to do with the fact that pi digits are base 10, so between 0 and 9. And so if you encode it into hexadecimal, you can probably do something like
that. No, it doesn't matter what base you put it into. It's a very irregular number. It doesn't have repeating digits, and it doesn't have many repeating patterns.
No. I know it doesn't, but you can store a number like 37 in hexadecimal as one byte instead of storing it as two individual bytes.
Oh, that's not compression.
It's... whatever. It's faux compression. So they also mentioned if the digits were stored in an uncompressed ASCII file, so just storing them just like we would normally, if you were to open up Notepad on a Windows machine and start typing out Pi, then it would take 8.32 terabytes, which is a lot of disk space. I don't know how many songs that is on iTunes, but it's probably in the realm of hundreds of thousands of songs, something like that, or millions. So anyway, pretty cool.
Alex, you've got some security news for us.
Security news. Okay, so some people have heard that there's a new way to jailbreak your iPhone, and you can just go to a website and click on something, and you goes and says, okay, I'm jailbreaking your phone, and you wait a few seconds, and it comes up, and you basically says your phone has been jailbroken.
Yeah, so what sounds the original great. Jailbreak was like, yeah.
Yeah, and well, exactly. And actually, I did not realize that until you had mentioned that when I was talking to you about it. It sounds very convenient, really great for people who are interested in jailbreaking their phone, except for one problem. Jailbreaking a phone is technically hacking it to get past the security controls that you can install the software you want. And this means that there is an exploit that can occur by simply going to a web page. The flaw itself is a vulnerability within the font processing for its PDF interpreter. And effectively what the new jailbreak is doing is using this exploit and uploading a PDF that then can execute code on the phone. And it's still... Even that code is still kind of contained, so it's using a second vulnerability in combination to break out of the sandbox of the application. And for those who don't know what a sandbox is, it's basically kind of a container around an application so that the application is not allowed to go outside. It's not allowed to read files or access other programs that are on the phone or do anything like that, except where the sandbox allows it to in a controlled manner. Right. Where it finds a way to get out of that and break out of its sandbox.
Right. So while it's extremely convenient for end users, it is basically the worst kind of exploit you could have for a computing device.
Yeah, exactly. It basically lets, you know, some program that you're, or in this case, just a web page, have free reign over your device. And so it's something that a lot of people are excited about because it's a really convenient, easy way to jailbreak your phone, whereas otherwise you had to have physical access and hook it up and run your program and, you know, reboot the firmware or reload the firmware. So it's a little bit more of a process. Here you just go to a web page and you press the button and away you go. And by the way, pressing the button is not a requirement. That's just a UI interface that the Jailbreak Me website has done. It could just be that you click a link in your web browser or just load your PDF in an email.
Right. Now, the original jailbreak back in, what was it, 2007, early 2008, something like that, had this problem. Why is it worse now than it was back then?
Well, it's the same vulnerability. It's still the same. Oh, I mean, it's not the same vulnerability. It's the same type of attack. And it is just as bad from an individual standpoint, except that was 2007, and now we're in 2010, and we use our phones for a heck of a lot more. I mean, everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people have their Facebook app and their app to Amazon and their banking application. And so they're doing things that you typically used to do more on your computer. It's all being done on your phone. And so when your phone gets hacked, there's risk of losing the credentials or something getting installed in the background that watches when you log into your banking website. I mean, there's all sorts of bad things, just like on your computer, because it's just a little portable computer that fits in your pocket.
Okay, so folks, don't start randomly clicking on links when you're in your iPhone.
Yeah,
and Apple does not yet have a patch for this. They should have one soon.
Right, there is no 4.02.
Right. When that comes out, I'm sure this will be fixed in it.
Yeah, and so that also means that if you have the iOS 4, you absolutely should be updating. Actually, do you know if this affects people who are on the older firmware?
I believe, I think on the iPhones, it's only 4. I have to double check that. On iPads, I believe it's 3.2 is also vulnerable.
Okay, so the 3.2
Yeah, this goes beyond iPhones, by the way. This is an attack on the iOS. It does affect iPod touches and iPads.
Ooh, scary.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, on that note, moving on, I want to hear from...
Real quick on that, too.
Yeah?
Technically, this vulnerability being in the PDF reader, it's part of a software that's a piece of software that's used by more than just Apple's iPhone. This actually affects computers as well.
So it was always back in the day of especially like Internet Explorer 5.5 and 6 and everything and Windows 98, we were always telling everyone, don't click on links just because you never know if there's a vulnerability, you know, and now we feel a lot better about clicking on links and saying, oh, well, my web browser is secure and everything like that. But typically, you still want to keep that mentality of, you know, just eternal vigilance, you know?
Right. And we've always talked about links in email. So this also means if you get an email on your iPhone, don't click on the link unless you know who it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. And you're certainly
for attachments.
Certainly with attachments as well.
So... Lindsay.
Mine's not nearly as scary.
Well, good, because, you know, we're not about, you know, scaring people.
Yes, of course not. Basically, Google Wave is dead, so it might be kind of scary for some people that have been relying on it and using it, but there are alternatives, and one of the websites I found listed a bunch of other tools that are free that you can use that have different functionality, but nothing quite as slick where it's all in one. Yeah. Were you going to say something, Ben?
Oh. Closer to the mic.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. There we go.
Can you hear me now? Good. No. Just to quickly jump in. So Google Wave is a collaboration tool, right? Mm-hmm. So if anyone doesn't know what Google Wave is, you go
it doesn't
to,
matter because it's going away.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, so if anyone has gone to Etherpad and gone to or ietherpadnow.com/geekspeak, that's the show page during the show. A lot of people will update and put content there. So it's a collaboration kind of thing. Google Wave was just a different way of collaborating.
Yeah, and similar Etherpad's what we use, and it has a lot of great functionality. Some of the things they mentioned were Yammer, which is a business microblog designed specifically for business purposes, and then Huddle, which is another collaboration tool that looked pretty neat. They have a free version that doesn't have all the bells and whistles. Plurk, which is a microblogger, Talkbox, which is a video conferencing thing, and Brizly, which is kind of Twitter-like interface. So I'll post a link to the page up there.
But sounds good.
Yeah, I have a friend who's probably going to be pretty devastated by this news because everything in his brain is on Google Wave. So it's actually very remarkable watching him when he uses his computer. Everything is on Google Wave. So I also noticed at the end of the news article, it said that at the end of the year, they may or may not be discontinuing it, but it'll be continuing to be used until at least the end of the year, and then Google will make a decision as to what to do with it. So
I do consider it sad because I did like the model. It was blurring the line between that email, the instant messenger, the editing a document, things like that. But it was so different, and it didn't integrate with Gmail, which meant that all of my existing stuff, or Google Reader for that matter, or any of the other utilities, so it meant that I had to open up a new window to work with Google Wave. But it took some time to get people to get interested in Google Wave. You had a lot of people who were just dismissing it out of fact because they're like, I don't get it, and walk away. Yeah. And so if there's no one else on it, there's no purpose to be there because no one else is using it. It's this chicken and an egg thing.
Yeah, and those barriers to entry, of course, are the having it in a separate window. That's one. Two, it's, as you said, so radically different. Like in the paradigm you have to be in to use it.
Well, the fact is right now we think of, okay, there's email, there's Instant Messenger, and then there's Google Docs or something
or
of that
Word
effect.
Even.
Yeah, that effect. And then there's online calendars, and we think of them as four distinct items as opposed to just putting it all together. And that is really uncomfortable, I guess, is the first time you try it.
Do you think it's just ahead of its time and that it'll come back later when people get their minds in that headset?
Yes. I don't know that it'll come back in the exact same form. There were some issues with it that you had to have some patience with it, such as the updates when it when someone else was typing, getting used to that model of someone else typing, there's going to be some other applications that's going to be a little less intrusive, not going to do as much. That's going to be like Subita Edit, for example, for the Mac, where you have multiple people typing. You get used to that by itself, and then you can integrate it in with mm-hmm. other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely are seeing a blurring of line, even with phones. I mean, one thing that's really interesting to me is Google Voice and using Google Voice. And I think Google's in this very interesting position because they've got their fingers dipped in all of these different, modalities of communication in different markets as well. And there definitely are ways you can integrate, say, text messaging or calling someone back with instant messaging, with email, with everything, you know. But it's breaking people out of their boxes of this is how I use my computer. And, allowing them to kind of making it easy for them to go from how they use the computer currently to the new way or a better way.
Okay. Well, and speaking of breaking out of boxes, and we're going to break out of the English-speaking world, Ben, you've got a story about the other side of the world?
Yes, indeed. In China, they have some very interesting plans for public transit, which I find absolutely brilliant. Basically what they are, it's basically a bus that rides above traffic, you know. And so, you know, my mind when I first saw the headline before I opened it up and saw the picture was flying car. Oh my God, China has a flying car. No, does not have a flying car or a flying bus.
Is it like the Go-Go Gadget car where it like lifts up above the traffic?
Yeah, exactly. No, well, actually kind of. So imagine you have a 4-lane road, right? Imagine you have a 2-lane road, okay, and cars are going on the 2-lane road and there's terrible traffic and the cars are all gridlocked, right? How do you get the bus to go above the traffic? Well, what if you had a bus with kind of these almost stilt things on the right side and the left side? So it's straddling these two lanes and the place where all the people sit is up above. And so they're actually above all of the cars. It's like a moving tunnel.
So I have a question then.
Yeah.
How do people get into the bus?
They have to climb a ladder. No, I have no idea. I mean, probably they build stations. I mean, you know, that's the idea. But basically, it's a bus on tracks. It's like a train, but it's on roads with cars, and it's going over them. So it's like a bus and a train and an
so
airplane.
So the train track and the road are one, are considered one
they,
and the
they
same.
They are, yeah, okay. Exactly the same. So,
well, that's clever.
It is very clever. And you take a look at these. Actually, when I first saw this picture, the picture that's on the article I'm going to be posting up to GeekSpeak site, so check it out. You see this these cars and the bus above. It looks kind of like a life-size artist rendition and everything. But then you look up at the top of the image and you see these humongous people looking down on it and you realize it's this little model. But they actually do have plans to do this. So they have a plan to build 186 kilometers of track, starting to build that just at the end of this year. So if that actually goes through, that could be really very, very cool.
Obviously, I'm really curious.
Yeah, Alex, you had a comment?
I was really curious about this, Ben, is I saw some of those sketches, and, I'm sure they're going to figure a way, you know, for how this is going to work and all, but when I look at those sketches, I see this big, huge, you know, train that's, 6 meters wide, so it's basically two cars in width, and it was taking, you know, it was riding down the two right lanes of this big highway that had mm-hmm. 3 or 4 lanes, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, okay, so those cars in those middle lanes that want to change lanes, what happens mm-hmm. if the bus comes at that time?
That's a very good point. That's the one thing I was thinking about all morning. I saw this story at about 6 this morning, and I couldn't stop thinking about how are they going to solve that problem. I'm sure they'll find something. I mean, one idea, of course, you know, the bus comes, and one of its stilt leg things, you know, it, like the side of the tunnel, if you will, because it's kind of a moving tunnel with people on top. You know, if that's coming and someone decides, oh, I see this bus in my rearview mirror, I want to switch this lane right now. You know, they might cut in front of it. There might be accidents. And also, you know, if someone crushes this stilt thing, you can imagine the entire bus tilting to the side and all the people flying out. It'd be like in a movie.
Yeah, let's not think about that.
But, okay. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure they can figure something out. I think the main idea is that the traffic in the districts that they're building this is so bad. This is my guess. That the bus is moving so much faster than the traffic that you don't really have much of an issue of that, of people realizing I need to get over to get to that exit, but the bus is coming, you know, make a decision. So that's my guess.
Okay. Alex, your next story? Since we're traveling, we went to China, now we're going to be heading back. What happened at the border?
Well, at the border here, and this is actually somewhat related to DEF CON, a tourer named Jacob Applebaum.
Sorry, say that again. A tour developer? What is tour?
Tour developer. Tor is a, I don't want to say a research project, but it's basically a system that allows for anonymity on the internet. That's the whole idea for it.
Okay.
So you can, you can either browse the web or access systems or, provide even services out there such that it's anonymized and people don't really know where it's coming from.
Okay. So one of the people that helped set this up.
So, this is, one of the developers for this, and I've seen him speak at DEF CON and Black Hat last year. I didn't get to see him this year, although he was there. The FBI had stopped him at the border, and this was in relation to some WikiLeaks, and they were interrogating him, and, they held him for, I believe most of the information is through Jacob Applebaum as far as what had occurred, but he said that, he was there detained for 3 hours. They took his cell phones. They took his laptops and gave back his laptops eventually, but they didn't give back his phones is the claim. And just a number of things where it's a bit of a question about, is this okay? Because while he was stopped at the border, he is a U.S. citizen. And they were basically, he also said that they were intimidating and threatening him that, every time he tries to enter the country, this is going to happen. And these are just more reports that we hear about it. So this guy also spoke at Black Hat, and he spoke specifically about Tor and, some of these projects that he works on. And I guess at the end of that, a couple of FBI agents also had approached him. And I believe that he just pretty much said he didn't want to have anything to talk to them about. And I don't know if he actually did talk to them, but, they said it was kind of related. He's like, well, are you aware of the incident that occurred? And he's like, yes, that's why we're here. So I don't know if they were trying to talk to them on a more friendly manner. But
it sounds like
anyway.
No one's talking to each other. Everyone's saying, well, there was kind of this thing. Was there? I don't know. Well, there was something that was said.
There was something that occurred. This Tor developer was stopped, and a lot of this is related to WikiLeaks, which is a website that is for, I guess, leaking information. A lot of whistleblower type stuff goes on there. But at the same time, recently there was a lot of people have heard this in regular news, a massive amount of data that was put up on WikiLeaks.
And they assume it went through Tor.
I think that's probably one of their questions. I don't really know what the FBI is thinking, but it's probably something that they're investigating. But at the same time, it's this big, huge thing where a lot of names and information, I forget the actual number, but it was ridiculously large in the thousands of the, pages of documents that were leaked. Because WikiLeaks is trying to get information out, Tor sounds like a very good process for which to try and mask where it comes from.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting in that manner.
Well, thank
but
you
it's just interesting combination of hacker developer who works on Tor for an anonymization website, WikiLeaks, the government gets in there, FBI shows up at DEF CON. It's another another day at DEF CON, basically.
Okay, thank you for that story. GeekSpeak on KUSB is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. So I have a little geek bit to add into all of this. This comes in from Ben and I went to TAM, the Amazing Meeting, a group of skeptics annual meeting, which I highly recommend for folks to go see. And this is a quote with regard to the folks on Ghost Hunters, a group of plumbers, as I understand, that have Geiger counters and random bits of electronic free-for-all. And a quote that was given by a gentleman named Benjamin Radford was, you may own the world's most sophisticated thermometer, but if you're using it as a barometer, your measurements are worthless. Just using as a calculator, just as using a calculator doesn't make you a mathematician, using a scientific instrument doesn't make you a scientist. And just because you're using a Geiger counter or just because you're using a thermometer doesn't make you a ghost detector. But that's just her own little geek bit right there. A little bit of skepticism and a little bit of wisdom coming from the James Randi Educational Foundation.
Fantastic.
So, moving on, Lindsay. So, Alex has once again scared us silly and made us all depressed.
That's
and...
what security people do, don't they?
Right. It's their job.
No, really, all of my stuff is safe. I don't have to listen to you.
But, Lindsay.
You know, Ben, I think that, and I was telling Miles this something similar, that I usually get to a point where I think, okay, this isn't so bad. We're kind of safe. Then I go to DEF CON, and that really sobers me up really fast. Just how messed up things are.
Yeah.
No, they're great.
But cheer us up, Lindsay. What good is happening in the world?
So there is some people at the University of Tel Aviv working on a biomimetic computer chip for brain stimulation. Biometric.
Oh, biometric.
Yeah. Was just something in the article. I thought it was amusing. Biomimetic. I don't think it's even a word. But
no, biomimetic is. It means that you're something that's...
Then that's what it is. It's biomimetic.
Sorry, I'm losing my words now.
Miles and I are looking at each other like, what's that
something
word?
Something that imitates life. Okay. Biomimetic, imitating life.
Then that's exactly
that
what this
life.
Is. Mimics. And I learned a new word today. Most computer chips for the brain are used for things like Parkinson's and epilepsy, where they send a constant electrical charge to keep seizures from happening. This one is actually intelligent, where it will learn your regular brain waves and program itself so that it'll only detect when there's something unusual going on and then send out the electrical charge. So what happens with people with the electrical charge that's constantly there, they become desensitized and they have to put a new chip in and it becomes a hassle. So this one supposedly will reduce the chances of becoming desensitized like that. It's also kind of like a pacemaker where they just install it under the skin on the top of the head. So if they needed to take it out and reprogram it, they could. And it has, long wires with specific sensors that go into the specific parts of the brain that it needs to target instead of just a general electrical stimulus. Right now, they're just practicing on rats, but they say hopefully within 4 to 5 years, they can have this out and be able to help some people.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Ben.
Yeah. Where's the segue?
Oh, there's no segue to this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go from real life to fake real life, 3D movies. Well, that was off the cuff. That's why it was so bad. That's my... All right, so anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about 3D movies. The ultimate discussion I'd like to have, I guess, amongst all of us geeks is, are 3D movies good or are they bad? Just to give a quick background, some of the issues that people have had with 3D movies is, you know, they've either gotten dizzy or they've gotten headaches or, you know, something like that. And I'm talking not about the red and the blue glasses. I'm talking about
the ones that are now a parallax.
Yeah, yeah, the ones that just look like sunglasses. You put you put them on and they're circularly polarized in opposite directions. So you don't really have any artifacts or anything or any changes to your vision when you look through the glasses, aside from everything gets a lot darker, just like when you put on normal sunglasses. But then you can see the 3D movie because they have special projectors and polarizers that are synced up. So some of the issues that we have, and these two, the two issues I'm about to bring up are with the production process of 3D movies, right? So when you're watching a 3D movie, let's say that your character is a couple feet away, or he looks a couple feet away, and then they cut to another shot. What happens to your character? Is he a couple feet away, or is he much further away? That's really the question. When you cut between shots, the main character or the thing that's in focus can get further away or closer, and that can confuse our eyes in 3D movies because our eyes need to refocus every single cut. Mm-hmm. In real life, we never have cuts, you know, so we don't have that issue.
Oh, we are in control of the cuts.
We're in control of the cuts. Yeah, we blink, right?
Well, but, and we turn our heads. Like,
yeah,
there's a sound, we turn our head, and we see that new item, but we're expecting it, and our brain has that anticipation and makes it seem seamless, even though it is disjointed.
Yeah, the whole idea of movie editing is you're supposed to cut between shots without it being noticeable to the person who's watching. But if you have to keep on refocusing, that's one. And you can kind of fix that by faking it and making the word for that is convergence, when your eyes converge together on an item that's closer or further away. And that's what you're emulating with movies. And the opposite of that is divergence, where your eyes spread apart. And the most they can spread apart is straight ahead. If you're looking at a mountain, your eyes are both going to be pointed pretty much parallel.
Yeah, infinite focus.
Infinite focus, exactly. But sometimes when you're making a 3D movie, you can accidentally make the images more than that. You can make them so your eyes actually have to spread apart from each other. And that can be very painful and extremely disorienting, right? So that's one of the other reasons people get headaches. Then there are two other reasons which are not because of the way they create the 3D movies, but just they're just intrinsic to the method, right? So one is a movie is flat, right? No matter how 3D it looks when you have the glasses on, they're just two flat images, right? So
it's like you're looking at a ViewMaster.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the question is, what do you want to focus on? Let's say you're focusing on the main character, but then you want to look at the tea kettle in the background, right? You can't change the focus from the main character to the tea kettle, because it's the focus is in the image. The image is flat, and you're not controlling the focus.
Right. I think we've talked about this before when we were in a car driving to Las Vegas for
Yeah, camp, we did.
Where the issue, as I saw it anyway, wasn't necessarily the technology, but the implementation, just as you were saying, where when movies first came out, they weren't done like movie pieces done today. They were largely like plays. You have there was a vast majority of movies that were made in the early days of movie making were you had someone interacting with another person, very much like a stage play.
And the cuts, there weren't very many cuts. It was very, very long shots, right? So you were looking from the same perspective for a long period
right.
of time.
Right. A Streetcar Named Desire is a one that immediately springs to mind for me. That is, it's a play being put onto a movie screen. And yes, they go out and you show them in the outside world and the sets are more elaborate or more to do with it looks like you are actually in the place as opposed to representing the place as you would in theater. And there was a transition that occurred where most movies aren't made like that anymore. Most movies are saying, this is a different medium. This is not theater. Let's bring the people into this 2D field. Let's bring them into the action, as it were.
Yes.
And directors and cinematographers have become very good at this. But
absolutely.
But 3D is not that case.
It has some intrinsic problems.
Right. I remember looking at Avatar at the very beginning where a little droplet of sweat or water comes together and it's out of focus. And if you're looking at the non-3D version, it's fine. You're like, that's something you always see in movies. But
if it looks 3D to you, you're going to try and focus on whatever you want to focus on.
Right. I saw this blurry, fuzzy thing in front of my vision. I tried to focus on it, but it would never come into focus. And it's because the director wasn't expecting you to put it into focus, and so that wasn't an issue.
Yeah, so that's something that can kind of be alleviated somewhat by good directing or them thinking about those things. But it's still an intrinsic problem with a medium. And then the other problem is parallax. So when you move your head from left to right, then I want to do that because the mic moves. But when you move your head from left to right, the things that are closer to you appear to move more. You can try it right now.
When you're driving down the road, the trees are moving faster than the buildings
mountain.
Behind them, which are moving faster than the mountains in the background.
Exactly. And that's why the moon always appears to follow you. And when you're a kid, you don't understand that. And so you're like, the moon is following me. But no, the moon is just so far away that you're not seeing the motion because it's so subtle. So I guess my question for the geeks would be, what do you guys think about this? There's definitely been this huge outcry from some directors who are saying, we don't want our movies in 3D, but they make a lot of money. So Hollywood wants to make them, right? So, go ahead.
I actually remember reading something recently. I think this was more based on, I'm not sure if it was movies or, sorry about that. I've got a phone ringing here. But I don't know if it was more based on photography or as movies or something, but it was talking about how we don't view 3D, we don't view 3D beyond a certain distance using stereo vision. Mm-hmm. You know, we see it, I think, you know, up to about 20, 30 feet, we actually use the stereo vision of having two eyes. But once you get beyond that, the differences are not significant enough that the brain just starts to ignore that and actually starts going off of visual differences in terms of size and things like that to determine three dimensions. So I'm kind of curious just, you know, why, you know, if a lot of that is just being ignored, or if that's actually being taken into account, or how that is for the movies that are in 3D. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of 3D movies, though.
Yeah, they're more expensive and you have to wear glasses. Especially for folks who already wear glasses.
That's true. Two pairs of glasses. That's stylist.
Yeah, it's two pairs too many.
Yeah,
Captain EO, that was cool stuff.
that's definitely a very interesting point. You know, if you have something that's 30 feet away and then mountains behind it, and it's using parallax for that, it's using convergence for that, then the entire scene is probably going to look smaller. Because if your brain says, hey, I'm using convergence to see the difference in size, then this must be a lot smaller than it actually is. So they probably do take that into account. But I don't know. My personal perspective is it's a great technology for some purposes, especially movies that are 90 minutes or shorter. And especially if you're dealing with someone who's done a lot of 3D as your director or DP, director of photography, or mm-hmm. something like that, where they have experience with those first two things I mentioned, convergence and divergence, and they ensure that you don't get your brain really confused, you know, because at the end of these movies, if they're done poorly, you can end up with a really big headache.
Yeah, I actually think it would be 3D falls into the realm of Blu-ray. Blu-ray sales haven't been doing all that well, even though people have high-definition TVs, even though they have high-definition projectors and the like. It's a lot of people just don't care about that difference enough to pay the extra money for all a new library of movies when DVD was acceptable to a lot of folks. And I guess I kind of see that here, where 3D may come out and it will be adopted by people who really like, for the same people who adopted Blu-ray early, will take 3D as well, will take to it. But the 3D will be best when you don't even notice it. Mm-hmm. Just like in movies, the best special effects are the ones you don't even know are there. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have people going, oh, it's so much better when you have the glasses. And they watch and they go like, oh, that was a really great movie. But I don't know that it'll be good enough, that incremental improvement will be good enough for the general public to say, yeah, that's worth me putting on glasses and making sure that I stick in the same place looking at it and that I pay an extra, you know, $2 or whatever, $5 at the movie theater.
You know, it's interesting, as this technology and as all technology has been improving and improving and improving, we're starting to hit these soft limits, these ceilings of what you need, right? Like CPUs. I mean, people still compare CPU speeds, but do they really need to, you know? Maybe graphics processing.
Do they even matter?
Do they even matter to us? Right. Yeah, exactly. Because if you're just checking email and going on the web, you're not using your CPU almost all of the time. You're using a little portion of it, right?
Right.
Same with hard drive space, right? If you have laptops that have 5 terabytes of disk space, which we currently don't have, once we get to that point, will anyone really need that much space? I'd say no. You know, same with resolution.
I don't know.
I disagree with that.
Yeah.
I'd say like video editors and people who do a lot of photography with RAW and everything, but I think that if people are checking their email and going on the internet and doing the relatively basic things, I would say you don't need them.
Alex, you ever retort to that?
Back when you were, I don't know, 5 years old or so, we used to actually, you know, sit there and think, we have a 120 megabyte hard drive. I'll never need more than that. The problem is that the industry finds new ways to fill it up. My web browser consumes 300-400 megabytes of memory. It used to be a tiny little thing, but they keep adding new features which bloat the memory need or the hard drive need. Image files are getting huge. And I take pictures now, they're 6-7 megabytes each, where they used to be just one or two.
Yeah, but
growing. And now I've got video I'm saving. You know, I'm taking my DVDs and putting them on my computer because it's easier to do it that way, or I'm buying movies online. you know, and then soon people will be buying HD, you know, for their TV just because it's when it comes down in price because it's there, it's easy, it's cheap. So they're finding new ways to fill that space faster. And yeah. I mean, I've got a, you know, not to mention we also tell everybody back up their stuff so they end up with twice that storage space.
Yeah, here's a scary stat for you guys. Here's a really scary stat for you. Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, mm-hmm. was recently at a conference and put up a very interesting stat, which was every 2 days or every 2 to 3 days, we increase the amount of human knowledge that is equivalent to the dawn of humanity till 2003. Take all of that information, and that is now being duplicated every few days.
Wow. Okay, so I'll say I'd like to put out a complete retraction on the hard drive side of things. I do still think that we're seeing that phenomenon in other things, like resolution for video, for example, as I would say evidenced by Blu-ray sales not doing so well because people don't necessarily feel like they need it. Yeah. And what's beyond Blu-ray? I mean, is that completely unnecessary?
4K.
Yeah, but do we need 4K? I mean, movie theaters oftentimes project at 2K, so...
Yeah, it depends on... Yeah, it also depends on how big the screens are going to get. Like, yes, you need at least
50 feet wide in your living room.
Yeah, what's the stat? You need something like either a 36 or a 42-inch before you even can appreciate 1080p? Like, any smaller than that, and it really doesn't matter.
It depends if you're talking about if you're talking about monitors or TVs, because TVs have much larger pixels.
But TVs,
yeah.
But even so, it's like if you're
something like that.
If you're sitting, you know, on your couch watching the TV, if it's smaller than that, it doesn't matter if it's 1080p or not. You're mm-hmm. not going to be able to perceive that difference. But if you start having, you know, projectors that you're wanting to put up onto a screen, and the image ends up being 200 feet wide, you know.
Yeah, but projector technology has been moving pretty slowly. We're still, most of our projectors are 1024 by 768 or 1280 by 1024, right? They're not even approaching 1080p, which is 1920 wide, you know? I mean, to get a projector like that with an aspect ratio like that, that's going to be numerous thousands of dollars, and that price hasn't been coming down very fast.
I've seen 1080p projectors, like the low end, at like 1500, but
1500, yeah. Yeah, they're very dim, though, so if you want to project them across 42...
Well, no, if you have the money to be buying a projector and having that setup that where you need that resolution, you also have a den where it's completely cut off from light and you have your sound array.
But that's my point. The very high-end users or the people who have a lot of money or the people who are really pushing the envelope need that extra CPU for their video encoding or something like that, but most users don't, so that's why... would state it as a soft ceiling or something like that.
Okay.
So anyway.
Well, very interesting discussion.
Something to think about.
So, Alex, can you come up with a story that doesn't depress us?
Oh, I'll try. Okay, how about a story on mind control?
A story on what, I'm sorry?
On mind control.
Mind control.
Used
mind
for good?
Control. Yeah, actually, it is for good. So it seems that... some of the first human testing for mind-controlled artificial arms are starting. So I believe we've touched on stories in the past about, you know, the cat that had the peg put in and had its limbs put on. We've talked about other prosthetics. Well, here they're actually starting the testing where they hook up the arm, you know, to a person and. Signals from the brain can't control it, and people learn to train their mind to be able to move the arm, move the fingers, the hand, and that sort of thing, much as they would a regular hand or arm, except it's mechanical. So once again, I need the sound effect, people. I need the sound effect. So yeah, looks like we're getting a little bit closer to the $6 million man.
Well, except that it's probably going to cost a lot more than $6 million.
Yeah.
Probably.
$6 million was,
you know,
so much money in the 60s.
For inflation and... Actually, I believe right now the contract that was awarded is $34.5 million.
Which would be more than $6 million.
Yeah.
That would be more.
By a pretty good factor.
So, body modification. Mm-hmm. Are we going to stay on a theme here?
And let's do it. Implantable eye telescopes. How about that?
Oh, okay. This is definitely $6 million man territory.
Yeah, exactly. Been spending too much time on the Singularity site. So there's a new implantable eye telescope that the FDA finally approved after 5 years of testing it. And what it does is it fits directly into the area where the pupil is. And this is only going to benefit people normally that are over 70, 75, that have age-related macular degeneration, where they get a donut in the, basically the middle of their sight. They can't see. They can only see the periphery, a circle around the edges. And so this takes what they would normally see in the center of the circle and projects it in a donut shape onto the good parts of the receptors in the eye. And they have to learn how to process that kind of vision, and it takes some time. There's lots of training, but yet another cybernetic thing going on. And so it's about 67% improved out of the 100% people, you know, the people that they tested. But some of the cases, because of the age range, there's healing issues. And so sometimes they have to actually replace the cornea because it does put pressure on the inside of the cornea and sometimes distort its shape. But, you know, the way technology is going, by the time we're that age, we will have cybernetic eyes.
Will there be any biology left?
Bicentennial Man dealt with that. Yeah, that was an interesting movie.
Yeah. Well, we...
So how much magnification are these telescopic eyes giving?
Right now, they're just programming them to have regular vision or slightly better. But they think that in the future, you know, it can be pretty limitless where, you know, if you're controlling arms with your brain, maybe you can control your telescoping eye with your brain.
So
see at distances.
What would happen if someone hacked into your arm and started controlling your
arm? Stop hitting yourself.
Okay,
yeah,
so
your eyeballs.
telescopic vision. Ben, your next story?
Yeah, I changed the order of my stories just for this. So speaking of telescopes, the Large Binocular Telescope, which is a telescope on Earth, just got an upgrade. So they just installed a high-speed adaptive optics system. And now they actually have a better optical quality than the Hubble Space Telescope.
Now, even though it's
even
earthbound.
Though it's in space. Yeah, so the biggest problem we had, this is the reason we put a telescope in space, is that we've got all of this, you know, pesky air in the way between
that's
us.
That's getting heated up by the sun and having little heat waves, just like when you look at a car on a hot day, it has those heat waves rising up.
Yeah, very much the same thing. And if you look at the stars, you know, we've got the whole stereotype of stars that twinkle, you know, and that's because of the atmosphere distorting the light from the stars as
assuming
it goes.
They're not a pulsar.
Okay. So anyway, but yeah, they have this this sensor that they installed, and it detects the aberrations in the atmosphere, the distortions, in real time, and it controls the mirror of the telescope to change its position to compensate. And this is like a technology that if you told me it would exist 5 years ago before we, I think it was like 5 years ago I started hearing about it, I would have said that's impossible. There's no way that you can detect, you know, atmospheric distortions and make, cancel that out with a mirror. I mean, that's crazy. But they've got this mirror that can make adjustments every 1,000th of a second. So that's 1,000 times a second, I would assume, with accuracy to better than 10 nanometers. So 10 nanometers is really, really small. So it's a pretty amazing system. And by installing this adaptive optics system, they multiplied what's called the Strel ratio, which is a measurement of optical quality, by 80 times. So this telescope is pretty much 80 times more clear than it used to be before this optical system. So really, really cool.
Very cool.
And a lot cheaper than blasting a telescope off to space.
Right. It does raise a question, though, with regard to if you have these things that are able to compensate for Earth's atmosphere, what is the demand then for space-bound telescopes?
I would assume diminishing.
Yeah, but I still think, I guess I wonder, and I'd be curious from any astrophysicists out there if they want to email us, as to what things you have to do in space to be able to look. I mean, the stereo telescopes where we're looking at the sun and able to find out about coronal mass ejections and stuff like that, that's a clear thing that needs to be non-terrestrial.
Yeah.
But
yeah, there have got to be other things aside from just the atmosphere that are an issue. I'm not really sure what they would be, but that would be a good question for an astrophysicist or astronomer.
Okay. So, coming back to Earth, Alex, your story?
All right. I've been nice too long. I need to give another scary story.
Oh, no.
You know, it's like when once DEFCON occurs, for a good couple of weeks after that, that's when all the you start hearing all these stories about the things that are going on, because so many things are announced at DEFCON. And a lot of the things that are announced are new exploits or new ways that they, you know, somebody has found to do something. Of course, they've been able to do this for a while, but they're just now announcing to tell people. So
yeah, what is it? What is this? What is this?
All right, all right. So your home router. Your home router is apparently got all sorts of vulnerabilities in it, at least certain vulnerabilities that where it can be taken over. One of the biggest problems is actually a human vulnerability. People don't change the default passwords when they buy their little home wireless router.
Most people never touch it. If their internet's working, then they leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And at DEF CON, somebody talked about some sort of DNS way to attack DNS so that they can get a browser to do something. I didn't attend that talk. I didn't think it would be as interesting as it sounds like it was. But effectively, they're able to get a person to able to access a person's router by getting them to access their router unknowingly and using default passwords to get in and make the router do what they want. Well, Verizon has decided to go in and has a way to connect to people's routers, which is very interesting because there's apparently a port that Verizon has connected for its Verizon Fios service to be able to get into people's routers, which technically the people own. So it's kind of an interesting little weird dynamic. And Verizon went in and modified the passwords away from defaults. And they told the users, you know, all that, you know, and such, but and it's a good secure thing to do. But there is still some question here about Verizon just being able to go into people's routers and change things. You know, it's like, what else can they do for people's home networks or, you know, from their home access? It's a little bit intrusion here. It's kind of along those lines when we were talking about being able to have the Android phones and the Android market go out and remove applications from your phone.
Yeah, it's that question of who owns it. You own the physical box, but do you own the bits within that box?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the old Microsoft computers had a default administrator without a password, and some people would set up their computers without the password unknowingly. I mean, what if they did a software update that, you know, you couldn't log into your computer and they had to let you know, oh, we changed your password for you. Good luck.
Well, it looks like you've wasted a perfectly good hour listening to Geek Speak.
Wasted?
Yeah. Well,
wasted this hour?
I'm stealing from Car Talk here. KUSB co-sponsors the Blue Ocean Film Festival, Tuesday, August 24th through Sunday, August 29th, featuring more than 80 films taking viewers into the ocean and around the world, from big wave surfing to deep sea exploration, plus ocean-related events and activities throughout Monterey. Information is available at blueoceanfilmfestival.org. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KUSP.